Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, America the Angry. We've all seen it, felt it, in the news, on the streets, behind the wheel, everywhere you look. Americans seem to have had it. Bank bailouts and bad schools, rising prices, sinking wages, the IRS, the SEC, pick your target. Americans are taking aim and letting everybody know it. Have we seen anger like this before? And where does it take us? This hour on Point, anger in America now and where it's going. You can join the conversation. Are you angry, angrier than you used to be? Should we be angry these days? Will we devalue anger if we're angry about everything? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from West Windsor, New Jersey, is anthropologist Peter Wood, author of A Bee in the Mouth, Anger in America, and president of the National Association of Scholars. Peter Wood, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Worcester, Massachusetts, Paul Starobin, national correspondent for the National Journal and contributing editor to The Atlantic magazine, joins us. Paul Starobin, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Tom. Glad to be here.
You're both writing about a kind of new flavor of anger. Peter Wood, let me come first to you. How would you describe it? What's new on the anger front? We've seen, I don't know, the volume sure looks new. Is there something about the way it's expressed or the way it's out there that would look out of place if you put it up against the sweep of American history or not?
If you put it up against the sweep of American history, what's different is that we've set aside our old injunctions that anger is a weakness best controlled and that the mature person learns to put anger in its place and let it out only occasionally and under very restricted circumstances. We've instead made anger something to be proud of. We have anger as empowerment. We have anger as a lifestyle. We have anger that has now just infiltrated every cultural context.
Anger as empowerment, would Americans, I don't know, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, have recognized that? Would the way we show our anger today, would it have looked odd or familiar to earlier Americans?
I think if you went back 50 years ago to the 1950s, you could see the very beginnings of this change. But go back before that, and it would look very different. Americans did not respond to, say, the attack on Pearl Harbor with the kind of anger that we have today. It was more a matter of let's focus and get the job done rather than this histrionic, theatrical kind of anger that is on display on television and talk radio and in blogs and pretty much is now the tenor of public life.
You say they
That's very different.
They didn't show that anger, but they went to war with Japan and dropped a nuclear bomb, more than one on it.
That's right. There certainly is no way in which you can write out of history that people do get angry. The question is, how do they display it? What social form does it take? And if it is a matter of going to war in a deliberative way, that's one thing, as opposed to this sort of ranting style that has become our hallmark of the present.
Paul Starobin, what do you see going on the anger front today? It's hard to miss it. There's so much out there, but is there a difference in volume or quality of the anger, the texture of the anger? What's new here, Paul?
I think the texture might be a good point. I mean, I think there probably are. I think certainly there are more vehicles for the expression of anger, and we can certainly look to the internet and the blogosphere for that. Though I would differ a bit. I think there's something quite eternal about the anger that we're seeing today. I mean, this kind of populist anger and rage really has its hallmarks to the beginning of the Republic, even before the Republic. It's a kind of Jeffersonian anger at big government, at the idea that, the people are going to have their decisions made for them by the elites. I mean, this was the kind of anger that motivated the original Tea Partiers back in 1773. So I don't think there's a particularly new kind of anger. I just think that anger is a recurring theme in our country. I agree that right now it's at a pretty high level, and that's an interesting theme to explore.
We'll look at when it's useful and when it's not. But what about Peter Wood? I mean, they've called it the Tea Party these days for a reason. The original Tea Party looked like a public expression of rage, anger, outrage, you name it. It looks like a predecessor, perhaps, of what we've seen today.
it was a controlled expression of anger. Paul has written about that himself, that they took care to destroy the tea, but not to break property, not to hurt people. It was a very kind of organized representation of a political feeling. And much of the American Revolution took that form. People certainly carried out violent acts, but violence and anger are not the same thing.
Paul Sterman, we're looking at anger because there seems to be so much of it in the air. We talked with our friend Larry Goodwin, a professor emeritus of history at Duke, though. And you know, Larry said to us, it's easy to characterize the people as angry. He said it's often a way that educated people try to discredit what he called organic kind of popular sentiment among lower classes, if you want to put it that way. Do you see that going on? It's not just those sort of folks in the street. There's some pretty wealthy people anyway in this country who express anger.
Absolutely. I mean, I've met with some of the Tea Party leaders in Connecticut, for example, and most of them that I discovered are kind of independent contractor types, you know, a lobsterman, you know, electricians, these kinds of people. You know, they're not people necessarily at the bottom of the economic scale. So, you know, I think we try to sort of sometimes attribute this anger to some sort of therapeutic, you know, causes, or we sort of wish it away. And when I think a lot of the anger we're seeing now is pretty rational, if you're looking at what's actually going on in the country, certainly on the, you know, dimensions of the economic crisis. And so it would be very surprising and I think probably worrisome if people were not angry. There's a lot to be angry about.
What about Peter Wood's observation that the original Tea Party, 1773, had a different quality to it, more deliberative, less, I'm not sure less what, but different in...
Yes, but we haven't really seen riots on the part of the Tea Partiers of today, have we? We have seen some acts of violence. I think they've been pretty infrequent. But, you know, the Tea Party rallies, I mean, there's a kind of edgy rhetoric to a lot of these Tea Party events, but we have not seen a kind of mob in any sense. So I think it's been pretty pretty controlled for the most part. You know, one of the interesting things that's happening now is, as angry as people are, you'd expect there for perhaps to be a lot more, you know, crime, you know, property crime, for example. But the crime rate is at an all-time low in terms of recent history. So I think the expressions of anger are largely coming out in the form of rhetoric, you know, the ranting and the raving. But, you know, we've had a lot of that in our history. I don't think we should become too rattled by expressions of anger as long as they don't become manifest in violence.
Peter, how about it? There have not exactly been riots. There have been some pretty rowdy get-togethers, pretty rowdy, and some guns in attendance, but it's not as though people have been, you know, burning down the Bastille.
I don't see the Tea Party movement as in any way violent. I think when you try to get a sense of the historical difference in anger, it's more a matter of locus of control. It's the individual who's angry today is usually practicing a kind of look-at-me anger. It's flamboyant. It's theatrical. It's about the self. It's expressive of a kind of personal quality. You can't find that historically in the Boston Tea Party or other outbreaks of anger. Even someone as passionately angry as, say, John Brown, led the raid on Harper's Ferry, an evidently angry individual, but it wasn't about him. He was very much directed at a set of external goals. Much of the anger we have now has this quality of saying, hey, look at me. I'm angry. I'm powerful. I'm important. And I think that cuts completely across political lines. You can see it on the left and on the right. In fact, I think politics is sort of the trailing edge of this cultural transformation. The anger that we're now experiencing in political life has already infiltrated the culture in many other places before it became the political wave as it is now.
So a kind of flamboyant anger, you're saying today, as a point of pride, as a sign of strength, and that as ahistorical, as not the American way in history?
Not at all. The great lessons that one can take from, say, George Washington, the man who eschewed anger, and he had a passionate temper. All his contemporaries knew he was a guy with an explosive temper, but they admired him for his capacity to tamp it down and control it. And that sort of mythology of the best way to produce your anger and keep it out of sight became the standard of American Stoicism. We see it all the way through popular culture, the movies, the Gary Cooper type, the man mm-hmm. who can't be provoked until he is absolutely provoked, and then and only then the anger comes out in a small, measured moment. This is the theme of American classics like Louisa May Alcott's Little Women. Joe, the young protagonist of the book, goes to her mother in an angry fit, and her mother says, "Hey, I've been angry every day of my life, but I've learned to control it, and you need to as well." That's not the lesson we have today. At least since the 1950s, when we began to absorb the lessons of psychoanalysis that holding your anger in is a cause of neurosis and it's dangerous, American popular culture has just been moving more and more towards this expressive individualism that says, express your anger. That's the way to go.
Paul,
that is just completely different from what America used to be.
Paul, we've got half a minute before the break. Do you see a flamboyance problem here, a missing stoicism in anger today?
When I think of flamboyance and theatrical demonstrations of anger, I suppose I think of Patrick Henry, give me liberty or give me death. I mean, I think we're talking about different strands in the American tradition. There is that stoical strand, and I think George Washington is an embodiment of it. There's also the flamboyant and theatrical strand. We saw that in Boston and Times Square of the Revolution. I mean, Tom Paine, we saw that in many of the Southerners. We certainly saw that among the Cavaliers before the American Civil War. So I think these traditions of anger have been with us for a long time, and they become manifest in different ways. Perhaps there's something going on in terms of the therapeutic generation, but I really do think the anger is a kind of eternal.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about anger in America, how we express it these days, and where it's taking us. Peter Wood is with us. He's author of A Bee in the Mouth, Anger in America. Paul Starobin is here as well, staff correspondent for the National Journal, author of After America, Narratives for a Global Age. Peter and Paul, first comments here from, well, here's one from Kate on Facebook. She says, I'm angry about politicians giving themselves the best health insurance possible at taxpayer expense and then turning around and saying it's unconstitutional to give it to everyone. So she says, I'm angry at politicians for bailing out Wall Street and then Wall Streeters turn around and give themselves multimillion-dollar bonuses. That seems understandable. Here's Joe from a website comment, says, are we angrier? Farm riots in the Depression ran bank attorneys and government officials out of town on a rail, and the rhetoric in our politics matched. Angrier? No, but our anger is much more well-documented, and that conflict is stoked by both our media and political cultures. Paul, what about the media piece? I guess that's pretty obvious. What about the stoking and the political actors these days?
Yeah, we're stoking. We're stoking. The cable, the 24/7, the news cycle, it's stoking. But you know, again, there's a long tradition of pamphleteering, for example, in American politics. I mean, you know, you want to look at vituperative media. I suggest you go back to the early period, the battle between the Federalists and the Jeffersonians, and that was vicious. So I think in some sense our media is returning to that kind of form, which I think in a lot of ways is regrettable, but yeah, it's helping to sort of feed the fire. But the fire, you know, as reflected in the kind of comments you're getting, I think is a sort of a genuine, you know, authentic grassroots sort of a thing. I mean, people are reflecting on real issues that they feel angry about.
Let's hear from our listeners. Maeve in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Maeve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Love the program. I'm a first-time caller. Great subject. I just wanted to say that I got rid of my cable TV due to all the yakking and constant barrage of anger on TV. It was putting more stress in my life than I needed. It doesn't mean I've opted out. I thank goodness for you lot. I'm from Ireland. Thank goodness for you lot. I listen to public radio news, and I don't go on the internet to hunt down news. I think, like your earlier speaker said something about 1950s TV and all that, it's true. The TV now constantly aims at us. They don't think they are, or maybe they do. They need support. But we're listening to things that we didn't really need to listen to, things that won't happen, hopefully, like Israel earlier, Israel invading or bombing Iran and all that. Political anger, financial anger, just constant. We're listening to it. And then if we're not getting that, we're getting 24/7 coverage of some pop star who pops his clogs.
Which could make you grind your teeth all on its own. Maeve, I'm very happy to hear from you, and thank you for calling. Peter Wood, what about the media, TV role as provocateur? There have always been pamphlets and pamphleteers, but is it different when we've got this saturation?
Anger is exciting, especially as a kind of spectator sport. If you're watching other people be angry and you're safe from that anger yourself, you know it's not going to be directed at you. It has this entertaining quality. We now have forms of entertainment that are even more remote. It's not on stage. It's on television, or you read about it. You can be protected from it. And I think that aspect of the consumption of anger as something that we watch other people do has grown enormously. Yes, it was there in the first decades of the 18th century or the 19th century. We had the wars of the pamphlets and things like that. But it's so much more intense now, so much more vivid. And we have people who now specialize in angry performances. They may not themselves actually be angry, but they know how to portray anger in a way that just gets people riveted by it. Not everyone like Maeve has the sense to turn it off. I don't think it's a particularly good form of entertainment. It has a sort of pornographic quality to it that we ought to be quite wary of.
Paul, we take your point about the history and the pamphleteers and Patrick Henry and all the rest, but is there, I mean, technology is powerful, saturation is powerful. Is there a difference in kind in the media environment today that makes this something different, that pumps up the theatricality at the cost of the substance?
Yeah, I think it's a matter of degree. I mean, I take all of those points. It may be different in the sense that the volume is greater. I don't know as a matter of kind that it's that different. I think really what matters in the end, if we're assessing, we seem to be assessing whether this is essentially a healthy or an unhealthy trend. And I would just suggest that we'll know if it results in anything meaningful in the sense of reforms, mm-hmm. for example, political and social reforms. I mean, the idea of a righteous anger is this, you know, as
yep.
old as the Old Testament.
Sure, I mean, is.
It was righteous anger that got Charles Dickens to write those marvelous novels about the kids who were exploited in those labor factories in Victorian
mm-hmm.
England.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? They cleaned up the factories. If there's a righteous anger today, which I think it is, there is a well-grounded basis for righteous anger, then we'll see whether it's productive or not in terms of the results. Right now, we don't seem to be getting all that far, but, you know, it's early days. It was a righteous anger, I think, in part, that elected Barack Obama. All that anger directed at George W. Bush over the Iraq War and other issues. So, you know, this anger is pretty broad-based, and it could go in some different directions.
Yeah, we're definitely not here to tut-tut, that's for sure, but we're looking to understand. David in Muhlenberg, Kentucky. David, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. How
hi.
Are you?
Pretty well. What do you see?
Well, I'm a small businessman. I've owned a construction company for about 5 years. This year, we haven't done any work at all.
Ouch.
And we've had all this stimulus that's supposedly, you know, helping the American people.
Right.
I'm not seeing it. You know, I've got a wife and 2 children. I'm about to lose my home. We've got this president who's naming people as czars. Now, is that not a communist or socialist title?
Well, I mean, there have been czars around for a long time in all kinds of administrations and certainly before communists. But let me ask you, I mean, do you feel yourself going around in a rage? It could be understandable if you're losing your business and your home, but do you feel anger?
I'm more upset than what I have been in the past. You know, the government is not listening to the people. You know, the majority of the people do not want this.
I think that was health care reform. David, you're breaking up on us a little bit, but I'm very glad for your call, Peter Wood. You know, here's David. He's coming on kind of he's got your reserve here in the way he expresses it, but someone who's losing their business and their home might very rightly feel pretty angry.
He's upset, he's hurt, he's suffering. but he's not theatrically angry. He does not have that quality that I've called new anger, which is this, look at me, I'm full of rage. I agree with Paul on this point that anger is always part of human nature, and it's always going to find social expression. It is a, to use one old-fashioned phrase for it, it's a good servant. It's a poor master. Our problem is that so many people have now let it be their master. And that's a cultural change for us. I think I could build out that case in a fuller way if I had the time. But I think all we need to do is just look around at the people who in public now make it a point of pride to be rude to other people in an angry sort of way or burst out in obscenities in places where it just wouldn't have been part of American life a generation or two ago to indulge in that sort of stuff. That it's in our politics now is just a fact, because it's in every other aspect of our lives. It's in our domestic lives. It's in our schools. It's in the public square. It's in sports. We have had sports figures now who were celebrities in part because they've mastered a style not only of performing well in their field of endeavor, but of making theatrical anger of it. And it goes back to McEnroe. It goes forward to Bodie Miller. We have this sort of racket-throwing, profane speech style of making ourselves visible as angry characters. That's what's different here, and I'm glad to see that the old forms of stoicism are still in play in people like David.
It's funny, we had a show here a few months ago on civility, and it melted down into incivility very fast, let me tell you. David's line broke up before I could get to it, Paul. I went, but he had kind of a Tea Party message there.
Yeah.
No to health care. He sees socialism, communism. Yeah. What do you think? I mean, people embrace the Tea Party or write off the Tea Party. What about the anger we've seen in that movement in particular, Paul?
Yeah, I do think, it has a kind of lineage. I see the ghosts of Thomas Jefferson here. I mean, this sense that, they are making our decisions for us, that there's too much power concentrated in the capital. I mean, Jefferson he imagined Washington, D.C. as being this kind of tiny little, province, and it would certainly not be, the master of the rest of the country. So this kind of tradition of federalism, I mean, it's the tension between Alexander Hamilton, who was very much kind of a control freak and a master versus a Jefferson. I think we're seeing a modern iteration of that, if you want to put it in those terms. So the Tea Party, yeah, they have all of these issues. One thing that struck me, he said he was upset. I mean, my concern is he might become somewhat resigned and depressed. If a classic definition of depression is anger turned inward, I have a concern that if nothing really happens, we will see kind of a national funk. I mean, we had some of that in the 1970s after the 60s, which was a very angry decade, but, arguably achieved a great deal in terms of social reforms.
David in Muhlenberg, we're rooting for you, and don't give up your spunk. Richard in Needham, Massachusetts. Richard, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Okay. What do you see?
I think that the problem that we're facing with increased anger is extremely symptomatic of a systemic problem of the vicious cycle and interplay between the gradual decline of American society and the loss of the American dream. I'm going to sound like an alarmist in the voice of doom, and people are probably going to tune me out, but I literally think that not only are our institutions becoming dysfunctional, but bowling alone, there's no community, friendships are often more scarce and problematic, a whole reason for why that book, Bowling Alone, was written. I think the 24/7 media cycle exaggerates the presence of crime and violence in our society. The increased incivility, to be biased about it, right-wing media increases the fuse of anger. And if you're going to talk about McEnroe, you got to talk about Bill O'Reilly and his anger all over the cable media. I just think there is so... Dick Cheney said the American living standard is non-negotiable. I think that's a real serious problem. And I think we're
you say it is going down. What's your bottom line in all that, Richard? That we're losing the American dream, and so the anger's justified, or we're being played as we wrestle with that problem?
I think it's both. I think it's really hard to tease out specifically and clearly why we're all so angry. But I have never seen this for decades and decades. The anger from the 60s pales in comparison to what we're facing. Incivility is extremely common, and there's something that is malignant that's going on, and I'm just going to sound like the voice of doom, and the sooner we realize it, the much better off we're going to be. Look at Washington and the gridlock. The Time and Newsweek just had cover stories.
Richard, let us pick it up. You got a lot on the table. Peter Wood, what about it? Richard looks across the sweep of history and feels more entitled to the anger right now, maybe, you know, justifiably than ever. It's sort of apocalypse now he's looking at.
Right. Well, I think entitlement to anger is precisely the problem.
I don't want to belittle it. I mean, he's saying it's justified. It's doom.
Right. Well, it's not doom. We will live through this as we've lived through every other crisis in history. What kind of nation we will be at the end of it, nobody knows. Mm. But to seize this sort of moment as exceptional, as having in it some quality of social disaster beyond any scale of reckoning in the past, just isn't accurate. Americans have had their history of wars in which we could have been absolutely destroyed as a nation.
Mm-hmm.
And we lived through those. We lived through famines and great pestilences and things like that, and we've come out of it. So I think that this capacity to turn the crises of the moment into something apocalyptic is one of the trigger points for this sort of self-indulgent style of anger. It says, look at me. I am so angry because I have suffered this in a way that all my ancestors haven't. Well, that's nonsense. Your ancestors have suffered way more than you. We have a very pampered life by objective standards.
Paul, so, how do you see it? An exceptional moment that justifies exceptional anger, or, you know, hey, life's never been easy, get in line?
Oh, no. I'm with Richard on this. I mean, you know, to talk in terms of an apocalypse, I think is excessively dramatic. But, oh, absolutely no question. I mean, if we're looking at, you know, basic standards of, you know, living in terms of, you know, real wages, the quality of education, health care, these are trends 20 to 30 years in the making where America has been a laggard compared to others in the world. And I think a lot of people are sensing that and waking up to it. I think that's one of the reasons why today's anger is so potent. It's become, you know, this kind of smoldering fuse that has been going on. I think Richard is giving some voice to that. I didn't really feel that he was entitled.
I didn't mean to say entitled, or justified would be much the better word.
Yeah, I do feel it's justified. I don't think it's particularly self-indulgent. I suppose people can wallow in their anger, but, you know, at a time of, this stubborn 10% unemployment, it's 20% by some measures if we count the people who have basically given up. If you look at the kind of stagnation we've seen in wages, it is a different period relative to, let's say, that long wave of prosperity that we had from the 1950s, you know, for at least another 20, 30 years. I mean, it is different in that sense. And so I think what we're seeing to some degree is a kind of generational realization that things are not getting better. You know, a lot of polling evidence on this suggesting that, you know, Americans are not so sure that their children will have a better future, for example. I mean, that's the kind of thing that can lead to some anger and, of course, unhappiness.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at anger in America this hour, how we express it these days, and where it is taking us. Peter Wood is with us, author of A Bee in the Mouth, Anger in America. Paul Starobin's here, correspondent for the National Journal, contributing editor at The Atlantic, author of After America, Narratives for a Global Age. And Peter, Paul, we've got lots of reaction. We'll get to our calls in just a second. Callers, we're very glad you're there, but we've got so much here from all that other media we've been hearing about. And by the way, in this hour, our Facebook account followers has gone over 5,000. If you've never checked it out, you really should. There's quite an active and interesting on-point realm there, on-point radio on Facebook. Over 5,000 fans or followers there right now. But let's look at some of this, if we may, Peter and Paul. Here's Dean. Web comment says, I think American anger comes from a petulant national personality. We are overindulged, frankly spoiled nation. Here's Deb. Here's a story for you. She says, within the last 6 months, I've lost my job, experienced the death of a parent, and am now forced to declare bankruptcy. I have occasional angry outbursts, no doubt, but I've chosen to truly feel my anger, examine it, and then channel the anger into positive directions. Instead of pointing the finger of blame, I need to change my life. This is fuel that will get me where I need to be. Then here's a comment from a patriot. Those we have entrusted with managing the moving parts of our complicated society have proven themselves untrustworthy. Government on every level, banks, our churches, the food supply, our jobs, our roads, medicine and health, the environment, the whole sorry planet. And that's just a sampling. We'll hear more. But, I mean, Paul, that last list, well, you hear all those, but that last list could get you pretty hot under the collar.
Well, you know, it's, what was the line of the Network movie? I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore.
Yeah.
I think it was from the 1970s. So, I mean, sure, there's an element of petulance in the anger. I mean, look, we're a nation of 300 million odd people, and, you know, we probably have about as many varieties of anger as we have people. And so, yes, there's a certain sense of spoiled and entitlement. But, you know, as these other writers are suggesting, I mean, real bad things are happening. So, again, it's sort of what do we make of it? You know, we can talk about it. Talking about it is good. But, you know, ultimately, are we going to harness it towards any kind of useful end? I mean, this is what I'm watching for.
Here's a Facebook comment from Catherine. She says, I'm angry that this country is always blaming the opposing side for the problems. What about that, the partisan quality of the anger, Peter? New or old as the country?
That one's as old as the country. Politics is oppositional, and it always has this quality of dividing people sharply along party lines. The interesting thing is how that's broken past the normal laws of politics, where you just leave it in the political realm, and now we've brought it into so many other parts of life. But that one I'm agreeing with Paul on. It's old.
Here's another Facebook comment, Paul, from James. He says, my largest concern with anger in our society is, as Tom Friedman writes, the existence of the super-empowered angry man or woman. The 9/11 anthrax letters are a great example of this. So who knows? You might think of the flyer with his airplane in the IRS in Texas. What about? I mean, this can get people pretty worked up. What about the super empowered angry man, Paul?
Well, I would suggest it's also an angry woman.
Yes, we say so. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are pathologies in any society, and certainly in ours. And, there's, you know, I think you'd have to link that to the availability of firearms in terms of being, you know, people being able to act out on what may, you know, be angry, violent impulses that may not result in kind of murderous death.
But we've been a gun culture for a long time. I mean,
sure.
Isn't the point now,
sure.
I mean, people have their own airplanes. They maybe,
yeah.
If they're expert, they have anthrax. There's,
yeah.
There's all kinds of options with a little bigger impact than a musket.
Yeah, it's worrisome. I mean, no doubt about it. We need, you know, very good counterterrorism intelligence. We need very good law enforcement on the ground. I think, you know, but in terms of the culture of violence and anger, I mean, this goes back a very long way. I mean, the South, but the pre-Civil War South was a tremendously violent place. I mean, you know, pistol duels, all that sort of thing. I mean, so this, you know, and again, is a
not to mention millions in chains and the whip and all that. Yeah,
yeah. I think one of the things that we worry about and we should worry about is just that modern technology, you know, anthrax and so forth, makes the actor out of this kind of anger potentially a far more dangerous person.
Here's a Twitter comment, Peter. This is from Daniel. He asks. What about how the culture of anger is affecting our children as bullying and bystanderism, I'm not sure what that, but go up across the U.S.? What about the impact on kids of this media-saturated particular strain of anger now, Peter?
I think it's a very worrisome thing, especially since children model the rules of behavior mostly from their parents and then from their peers. And as we lose the capacity to show children how you take in provocations and don't let them overwhelm you. We're producing children who themselves inhabit this kind of emotional chaos. They don't know what to do with provocations. And bullying and being bullied are hugely on the increase because of that.
Let's go to Elizabeth in Montreal, Canada, looking in from across the border. Elizabeth, thanks for calling.
Yes, when Paul gave that litany of examples, I think he was pretty much on the money. I live in Canada, in Montreal, and I think comparisons might be helpful here. First of all, I lived in the States for 7 years, and every time I had a conversation with somebody, there seemed to be like a lot of hostility and disappointment and anger, of course. And I didn't quite get the point of it all. I didn't quite understand until I realized that there is no social safety net for Americans. So every time the discussion of taxes comes up or other issues per se come up, people are really furious. In Canada, in Montreal, and in Quebec, we have a social safety net from the cradle to the grave. I mean, that's fantastic. I can bitch in my country. We have a prime minister who we have problems with. But I'm never afraid that all those necessities of life are going to be taken away from me. I'm never walking around, you know, treading on thin ice. It's not the case.
And what about the American championing of freedom as opposed to, you know, social safety nets?
You know, the American championing of freedom, look, we have our champions here too, you know. But this rugged individualism, you live or die, you're on your own in the States. You're on your own all the time. Nobody ever has your back.
Elizabeth, let us hold that right there. I appreciate your call very much. I want to get one more to write it behind it. Rock Hill, South Carolina. Jason, you're on the air. Thank you, Elizabeth. Jason, you're on.
Hi. How you doing?
Pretty well. What do you see?
Well, I'm angry. I'm angry at a lot of things. I'm angry at the people of the United States.
Isn't that you?
We basically come home from work, and we sit and we watch this stuff happening. And, yeah, we go to, you know, we vote in elections, but we're not doing anything about it. I mean, Barney Frank was dating, what, the guy who was in charge of Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac? You think they weren't discussing how to make some money?
I mean, I don't know anything about that, but what's your point there?
People, and it's Republican and Democrat. I'm not saying it's one or the other. But we have not physically risen up and said, enough. You people are stealing our lives from us. You're enriching yourselves. You're corrupt. The taxation in this country is abominable.
Jason, let me ask you, if I may. We just heard, you probably heard from Elizabeth in Montreal, a Canadian, saying, you know, Americans have a lot of hostility, and she thinks as a Canadian, it's because as she says, nobody has our back. We don't have a real social safety net Canadian style here. What do you say to that, Jason?
Guess what? I don't want the government to have my back. I want the government off my back. I want to go out and make it or lose it on my own. I don't need the government. The government should be taking care of infrastructure, should be taking care of the military, should be taking care of the things that the Constitution said the federal government was supposed to take care of. I don't want it in my life. If I fail, that's my fault. It's either my own ambitions were not strong enough, or I didn't have it inside of me in the first place. But I don't want the government stealing my life to provide a safety net for other people who maybe aren't as motivated as I am.
Jason, we got it loud and clear, and I'm very glad for your call as well. Paul, what do you hear in those back-to-back calls from Montreal and Rock Hill?
Yeah, I mean, fascinating. I mean, there's your debate right there.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's very perceptive. I think economists have very well documented that America has become a kind of more sort of higher risk society. It's not just about the government. It's, you know, this high wire. It's about, you know, corporations used to provide, for example, pensions, you know, for their employees. Well, that's been, you know, way cut back. And so people, you know, objectively speaking, are more on their own. And I think anger can be a condition of helplessness. I mean, it's just another side of the coin. But, you know, this sense that the government is on people's backs, I mean, that is what's animating the Tea Party folks. I mean, I think that's a powerful current. And, you know, I understand what he's saying, and I don't think that dimension of things has really played itself out yet. You know, we may see it crest as we get towards the midterm elections. It's basically a very anti-incumbent sentiment in political terms.
And Jason there saying he's angry with the American people for not doing more about their unhappiness. What about the, you know, how you go from anger to utility, the usefulness of it, or how it gets put into play? I don't know, maybe at the effort of who gets out in front of that anger, who rides the tiger, the leaders who tap it.
Right, who organizes it. And, you know, I agree here that with Peter that, you know, if we become too much of sort of a couch potato society where it's just kind of theatrics and it's fritted into the ether, so it does have to be organized. And we've seen good and bad examples of that in our history. I mean, Huey Long, do you remember the kingfish from Louisiana, one of the great populists of the Depression era? I mean, he rode that angry tiger. And he did a lot for the state of Louisiana, even though he was, you know, corrupt and lots of other problems. So, you know, we could see today's anger get behind some new kind of potentate, whether it's a Sarah Palin, whether it's, you know, Governor Rick Perry of Texas who is riding this Tea Party movement. So, yes, we need to see what kind of focus and direction. And I don't think any of us wants just to see people kind of, you know, sitting back in front of the TV set and kind of absorbing the anger and that sort.
Is that new potentate an opportunity or danger, or how do you see it? You cite Huey Long. He's not exactly looked on with universal admiration from this vantage.
You know what? It's true, but he did a lot for the state of Louisiana at the time. He took on Standard Oil. He built roads. He got textbooks into the schools, and he rode that anger in a very calculated way. So it's an opportunity, and it's also a danger, whether, you know, it's the kind of thing that can give rise to a demagogue, you know, who can speak to that kind of public anger. It really depends on the person who ends up in embodying it. It's interesting that Obama, you know, as I said before, I think he was elected to some degree in a tide of anger, and yet he does not come off as an angry man. In fact, just the opposite. I think people who voted for him are, you know, sometimes worried that he's altogether too calm, cool, and collected.
Pump it up, Barack. Florence in West Hartford, Connecticut. Florence, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. Phew! Yeah. That's how I feel.
Okay, what do you...
so much. Paul is right on target. But I will say this, basically. I've been on before, and I've talked about my parents, Italian-Americans. My papa's been dead. He'd be 100 now. We never took a handout. I call them true Yankees. My pop fed the neighborhood. You had a program on generosity.
Mm-hmm.
My husband got cancer. I had Blue Cross CMS. I worked till I was 77 years old, and I'm disgusted with the gentleman who wrote the book who's on there that says that we want entitlement. Bull on that. I never took a handout. My son has been downsized 3 times. Yes, I'm upset. Not only angry, I'm upset to be accused of not holding my own. I expected my children, and I worked hard. I worked for 76 years. I took every damn job known to man to get my children educated.
Mm-hmm.
And you know who sold us out? Big money, big corporations. And my husband's cancer. We are broke. I had to pay out of pocket. They would not take Blue Cross and CMS. I don't know what else to say.
Florence, you don't need to say much else. You make a big statement right there, a very strong one. 76 years at work and then feeling kind of... thrown over at the end? Peter, Florence says no thank you to the entitled American tag. You know, it just doesn't seem like a fair shake how it's worked out in her situation. You can hear it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly hear her distress. In the matter of anger, she seems to be sort of shooting out in any number of directions. It's not a kind of coherent, focused anger of the sort that Paul thinks would potentially yield good political consequences.
But what's a regular person supposed to do with that sort of litany of hits that she's taken after what she and her family have put in?
What's a regular person to do? Well, one thing is that maybe we just come to reckon with that life has about it qualities in which it's best to learn to endure, to try to do the best we can with a bad hand. And
but
many
she's
of
feeling ripped off by a system. You know, she's feeling ripped off by a healthcare system in this case in particular. I mean, there's more than a bad hand, right? It's a democracy. We're supposed to have a hand in its structure.
Right. Well, she can vote for the candidate she thinks is going to go up against big money, but tell me which candidate that's going to be. It seems to me the political system doesn't offer an answer to someone who has that kind of existential distress. She's suffered a lot in her life, and I deeply feel the pain of that, but I don't think that it points to a political answer.
Peter, you describe a new anger, more out there, more public, less stoic. Where do you see it going in our politics, Peter Wood? We just got a little time left here, but how do you see it playing out, perhaps similarly or different from earlier eras, with a different manifestation of anger?
I think that the kind of anger we have now eventually burns itself out. That is, it's become a dysfunctional aspect of our national character. A new generation is going to come along that just doesn't want to engage in vituperation as a lifestyle, and perhaps we're just going to have to endure this as the baby boomers, who are the impresarios of anger and who feel greatly pleased that they can hold themselves up as having suffered more than anyone else in human history, finally shuffle off the stage and we get a more mature body politic.
I don't think Florence is a boomer at 77, but Paul, what about it? Anger as a dysfunction or rocket fuel? How do you see it playing out this time?
Well, no, I don't think that people like Florence should be enduring their anger. I think that we live in a democracy, and that people like Florence, she presumably has neighbors, she has friends, she has people in her family. I mean, she can organize. I mean, one of the great things about the Internet is that, you know, you can reach out to other people who feel the way you do and try to make something productive of it. I mean, there's nothing really determined here about where the anger goes. I mean, if it's a properly focused and righteous anger, then, you know, it might have a lot of potential. I mean, I would end with, you know, with Aristotle, one of my favorite quotes.
Make it quick.
The man who's angry at the right things and with the right people is praised. So praise be the anger.
And that's all we've got. Paul Starob and Peter Wood, thank you so much. This is On Point.